She inspires, educates, and informs. She talks the talk and walks the walk. She doesn't tell you what to think. She just wants you to. She's Mrs. Green. And this is Mrs. Green's World on the Mrs. Green's World Network. And now, Mrs. Green.
Welcome, everybody. This is Gina Murphy, darling, and you are indeed listening to Mrs. Green's World, a fun and informative place where we don't ever tell you what to think, but we just want you to. Thanks so much for joining us and for being a part of Mrs. Green's World. And as always, a big thanks to one of our amazing partners, the Chapman Automotive Group. The motto for their Community Green team is doing our share, showing we care, and indeed they do. They do sell some of the most fuel-efficient and clean-burning cars on the market today, and they give back to their community in significant and intentional ways, and I'm proud that they are a partner and a sponsor of the Mrs. Green's World mission and vision. Thank you, Chapman. For more information, please visit them at chapmantucson.com. So here we go, everybody, for another excellent adventure with Mrs. Green. It's going to be a fascinating, informative show, a topic we have never covered, and we really do have an amazing guest for this next hour. We're going to be talking about making contact, new approaches to cracking the communication of dolphins and whales. So please join me in welcoming James Nestor. James is a journalist with a passion for extreme adventure, and I want to underline hashtag extreme adventure, who has written for Scientific American, National Public Radio, and the New York Times, among many others. He has written what is called a mind-boggling, multiple award-winning book. I could spend five more minutes on the awards that it has won. The name of the book is Deep, Free Diving, Renegade Science, and What the Ocean Tells Us About Ourselves. James Nestor, thanks for being with us for this hour.
Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, there's a lot to cover. And I always like to say the journey of a lifetime begins with a single step. And you have taken many, many steps into the deep and the abyss and the dark waters and a lot of other things. So what were some of your first steps that got you on this life of really and truly an adventurer and an explorer and, you know, probably a renegade? I'm not sure about that part.
Well, I've always enjoyed the ocean. I grew up near the ocean, and I used to body surf as a kid and surf and boogie board and all that. But I had never really taken the time to look beneath the surface until I was sent on assignment by Outside Magazine a few years ago to cover something called the World Freediving Championship, which is a very weird competition in which divers challenge one another to see how deep they can dive on a single breath and come back to the surface conscious. And if that sounds insane, it's because it is.
It is insane.
It is absolutely crazy. These people are coming up unconscious. One guy was dead for a couple of minutes before he was resuscitated. So, you know, seeing someone use just their natural body to dive down 300 feet was absolutely mystifying and incredible, but it seemed kind of pointless that they were doing this specifically for competition. And so luckily at that competition, I met some other more philosophical freedivers who said, hey, this stuff is silly. I'm going to go take you to, you know, the real freediving. I'm going to show you what this is really used for. And I followed those people, and everything kind of changed after that.
And I have to ask you this, because Mrs. Green's World is all about fun and connection and great information. I did watch your presentation for Google. Tell everybody what your mother said when you called her and told her that you had observed this. It was pretty funny.
She does that all the time. She never quite knows where on the planet I am at any given time, and I try to update her, but it's difficult at times. So I remember calling her after seeing these divers dive down 300, 330 feet without fins, without oxygen tanks, you know, just with a pair of goggles and their natural bodies. And she said, I don't believe it. It's impossible. There's an oxygen tank down there. You need to do your research. This is total BS. But I did my research that night and found that if these people were cheating, let's say they did have an oxygen tank down at the end of this rope, 300 feet deep, Well, they would have died if they would have taken a hit off of that oxygen tank, because their lungs would have exploded as they ascended. So it's only the human body in its natural form can withstand the pressures of such a deep dive. Even beyond the most sophisticated technology, the most sophisticated diving equipment, the human body is more efficient.
And I can't even explain this next question, but I know that what I thought about when I was reading and watching the films and trying to even get my head around it, do these people have like 0% body fat, and do they have anything that propels them to go down that deeply?
Well, that's the amazing thing about freediving, is it is truly open to anyone. You can, you know, basketball, to play basketball, you're going to need to be, you know, at least 6'4", right, 6'5", above. Other sports, football, you're going to have to be a pretty big person. But with freediving, you can do it if you're short, if you're tall, if you're heavy, if you're skinny, doesn't matter. As far as getting down that deep into the water, something amazing happens at around 30 feet after the first atmosphere underwater, is buoyancy reverses. It's all true. Instead of the water bringing you up to the surface, it turns around and starts gently dragging you down. And that's something freedivers call the doorway to the deep, because once you dive down to 30 feet, you're in zero gravity. You're not going up, you're not going down, you're just sitting there. And a little further down from that, you will start gently falling, the way a feather might fall in air, just very gently falling down. So you don't need any extra weights. The human body is the perfect buoyancy to free dive. We're really meant to do this. Maybe not to 300 feet, but, you know, to 50, 60 feet, we're built with incredible mechanisms and reflexes to do this. We're meant to be in the water.
And, you know, it's kind of jumping around a little bit. And I, full disclosure, I'm always honest with my guests. I did not read the book. I had to read the book for everything I did, but I do enough research. But I did read that you made an award-winning documentary called The Click Effect about freediving. Mm-hmm. So tell me what that was about.
Yeah. So, you know, you can explain a lot of things in photographs. You can explain a lot of things in writing. But still, people had a hard time getting their heads around the fact that when you freedived and you were unencumbered by any equipment, how instead of swimming away from you, everything swims towards you. That means whales, dolphins, fish, anything, octopus, you name it. So I was working with some researchers who were doing sperm whale and dolphin communication research, and they had collected hours and hours of 360-degree interactions with sperm whales. These animals are 60 feet long. They have 8-inch long teeth. They could, you know, kill you without even thinking about it, but instead the animals came in peace and would envelop them in pods and communicate them with them. And so we were approached by the New York Times and the Sundance Institute with a MacArthur Foundation grant to do a virtual reality piece for the New York Times. And this piece wasn't done with computer graphics. Everyone thinks it was. It was not. This is all real encounters where you can dive face to face with sperm whales, commune with them, interact with them. And so that's what was released by the Times on April 18th of last year. And we're doing more virtual reality experiences with different animals so that people can see that these animals are conscious, that they're sentient, that they are intelligent, and we're hoping that that will inspire people to preserve them and annihilate them off the face of the earth.
Yeah, we're going to talk about that too. What's going on currently this day in our country, of course, makes the. You know, what I'm doing and preservation of the planet top of mind every day. Like, what are we going to hear next that's going to be bad news? And I don't want to be, you know, Debbie Downer, but we'll talk about that hopefully a little bit later in the show and what people can do to be inspired and, you know, get in action. But I first heard you speak at Bioneers Conference in October, And I remember sitting there totally mesmerized. And Josh Fouts, I believe he introduced you. He's the Bioneers executive director. And I just want to do a little quote about what he said to give our listeners a sense for what was happening to me. He said he'll describe how groups of athletes and scientists plumbed ocean depths and researchers collaborating with engineers from Apple, Google, and elsewhere to crack the, I think it's called cetacean code, language code, and send messages back to these giant marine animals to make contact. Their weird and wondrous new discoveries might just redefine our understanding of the oceans and ourselves. Another amazing guest with unbelievable experiences to share with us. So at that point, I had my program, and I'm like doing stars, five stars, writing to my show producer saying, Kelly, we have to get this guy on the show. So tell us some of what you shared there. And I always like to hear about some of the weird experiences, what that word is in there, and a lot of what is written about what you do.
Yeah.
Talk about the weird.
You know, it's funny. It's weird to other people, but once you get in the water and begin to free dive in a meditative way, these experiences become completely natural. One adds up to the other,
right.
Which adds up to the other.
Right.
And so just part of my trajectory, so from being introduced to freediving in such a negative way through these competitions and these people who are passing out, I had zero interest in freediving myself. Like, I have no death wish. I'm not into like crazy adrenaline jacking sports. I think
right.
Base jumping is ridiculous. So, it wasn't until I really got involved with these researchers who were using freediving for something completely different. It wasn't a competition. It was for research. It was to commune with oceanic animals in ways that no one else can unless you're freediving. So once, you know, so after weeks of sitting on the deck of a boat and watching these guys come up when their eyes just glazed over and dazzled by the experiences they were having with these animals, you know, they sat me down and said, you need to do this. You can't write about this from the deck of a boat. You need to get in the water. You have to, you know, join us in this and experience this yourself. So I started a very different kind of freediving training with people who understood our connection to the water and our connection to ourselves very differently. These people respected their limits. They said it's, you know, the human body is really well adapted to let you know what it wants when it wants it. So when you want a breath of air, you don't fight against that reflex. You just go up to the surface and get a breath of air. The great thing about freediving is freedivers do not get the bends. You can dive down as far as you want and come up as quickly as you want, and you will never get decompression sickness, which is a chronic problem with scuba diving.
I know, and that's amazing. That is just amazing to me. Because that's one of the dangers of scuba diving.
That's exactly, and it happens to people all the time, even when people are diving within their limits. So when you're free diving, if you're down 50, 60 feet and you want a breath of air, you just, you know, kick a bit and you go up to the surface and, you know, a few seconds later, you're breathing. With scuba diving, if you did that after being down at that depth for a while, you'd probably die.
Right.
So it really removes some of those barriers that people have with scuba diving, the fact that you are trapped underneath the water at 20 feet until you can go up and you're running out of air. So once you get over the really frightening part of freediving, the frightening seeming part of freediving,
the first step,
which is the first step, exactly. And you see people do this in a responsible, you know, very safe way, some of the death-defying, adrenaline-jacking, you know,
scares me just to hear about it aspect, yeah.
But you know, something really occurred to me when I went to Japan and found the Japanese AMA divers. These are women divers who have been diving off the coast of Japan for more than 2,500 years. And it's this tradition that's been passed down from daughter to mother and mother to daughter and so on. And seeing how I found a few of them. There's still a few left. They were in their 70s and 80s, have been diving every day since they were 15 years old. And seeing their relationship with the ocean and the relationship with their bodies and seeing how cognizant and aware they were physically, mentally, spiritually, really opened up a door for me to make me think, like, you can do this in a meditative way that's nurturing and not competitive. And after I hung out with them for a few days, I came back and was ready to go.
And dive in you did. I mean, and even when you were talking, it was like taking my breath and slowing it down, because the thought of doing that, I think for most people, is terrifying. But you, it was transformed because of people that you observed and watched. I mean, what a beautiful story. That's what I have to like press pause and say, wow, it was a very, very deeply personal journey for you. I want to know about things like with Google and Apple, I mean, some of the biggest names in the world, what was their interest? What are they? There's always got to be a reason. Maybe it was just their love of the ocean and to learn more about it. But what? Why such an avid interest on the part of big companies like that?
Well, that's funny. I have to do a little correction here. I'm not sure where Josh got both of those names. We have been working with Google. We do know a few people at Apple who are very interested in helping, but they are not, just to be clear, they are not actively assisting in these algorithms yet.
Okay.
We hope they will be soon. But, you know, I spoke at Google. We're very good friends with the leader of Google Oceans, and we've been working with the UN for the past about 6 months to bring awareness to cetacean issues. Those are all real things that are happening now. The thing is, we're at Darwin, that's the organization that collects data on cetacean being dolphin and whale communication. We're really good at collecting data, but we need some very high powered computing to translate all of this data, all of
right.
these clicks and whistles.
Right. What you're finding out.
To figure out what it is. And luckily, this stuff, you know, 20 years ago wouldn't have been possible, but there are so many machine learning and AI programs out right now that hopefully we're going to be able to put this data into one of these programs and start to learn what these animals are saying. They just did this with bat squeaks. And two Israeli researchers built a machine learning program, did this, and they're figuring out what bats are saying. And so if we can figure out what bats are saying, well, we know dolphins and whales have much more sophisticated communication. And I think that we'll be able to peer into their communication very soon.
You know, I have to go back to what you said, because it's so critical. And it was right at the top of the show where you talked about, you know, I boogie boarded and I did this and I did that. And one of my favorite guests ever is Heather White, who is now working at Yellowstone. She was head of the Environmental Working Group. And one of the things that she said, and I think it's really important to point this out in every one of my shows, connecting young people with nature in any way, shape, or form is what anchors us into that connection never going away. And you got it there. I mean, I have interviewed so many guests who talk about my journey began in a tide pool, you know, Sylvia Earle. She was down the shore, right close to this Jersey girl. And those connections, if you're exposing younger people to nature before the age of 14, it sticks. And that's what happened to you. You got to be out there. You got to feel it and know it. And I don't think that connection ever goes away, because we are connected to the oceans. And, you know, God help us for the shape they're in now, because we're going to talk about plastics a little bit later on in the show. So we are coming up on our first break, which I find hard to believe. But when we come back, I'd love to get into a little bit about, you know, what you found about whales communicating for 100 miles away and sharks that swim in pitch black waters. I want to even know how you filmed that, or how did you know that? And then some other phenomenons about the hidden potential. The remarkable potential about, you know, echolocation and directional sense and all those things. We'll get a little bit more into the science of it, because I have a lot more questions and we have to answer. I don't know if I got that question answers about, I always like to hear the weird, what were some of the weird things, so you can think about that before we go to break. Everybody, we're listening to James Nestor, who wrote an award-winning book called Deep, And it's just, I mean, it's free diving, renegade science, and what the ocean tells us about ourselves. And I guess what's surprising the most to me, James, is how this is a relatively recent adventure in the scope of James Nestor's wild and crazy experiences. Everybody stay here with me. We'll be right back.
Join us for a new on-demand podcast every week at MrsGreensWorld.com. Listen on your computer or mobile device using the iHeartRadio or SoundCloud mobile apps. We are a proud member of the iHeartRadio, Glimmerglass, and Speak Up networks. Connect with us on Facebook, Twitter, Pinterest, and Instagram. Stay in touch with information about healthy living, sustainability, contests, and events by signing up for our e-newsletter on our website. If you have questions or comments about the show, write to us at info@MrsGreensWorld.com. We'd love to hear from you. But right now, back to Mrs. Green.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm Gina Murphy-Darling, and this is Mrs. Green's World. Thanks for joining us. Joining us this hour is James Nestor, and I'll tell you a little bit more about him again. He is a San Francisco-based author and journalist who has written for Outside Magazine, Scientific American, National Public Radio, The New York Times, and many others, and is the author of the multiple award-winning book, Deep, Free Diving, Renegade Science, and What the Ocean Tells Us About Ourselves. And when I say the book has won numerous awards, I mean numerous awards. BBC Book of the Week, finalist for the Penn American Center Best Sports Book of the Year. It's an Amazon Best Science Book for 2014, and that is not an easy place to hold. BuzzFeed 19 Best Nonfiction Books of 2014, New York Times Book Review Editor's Choice, Scientific American Recommended Read, and the list goes on. And James, thank you again for making the time to be with us.
Absolutely. Great to be here.
So talk about why do I have such a fascination with weird? Because I love weird. Normal is so overrated. So can you talk about, were there really weird, or was that just Josh's words?
Well, it depends from where you're coming from. I just want to pick up on one thing you said earlier about being exposed to nature as a young person.
Yes.
I certainly had that experience with the oceans, which is why I still try to surf every day. Right after this call, I'm going to go out and surf in the ocean and reconnect with that. But one of the most inspiring things that I've had since the book has come out is hearing from young people who are now interested in exploring the ocean and learning about the ocean and free diving, you know, down to 5 or 10 feet, very safe depths. And Hanley Prinsloo, one of the main characters in the book who really introduced me to this world, is now working in various countries throughout the Caribbean and Africa to expose children who have never seen the ocean to the wonders of the underwater world. Her foundation, I Am Water, is doing some incredible work. And I really think, like, that is the key to preserving this massive, area that houses so many incredible animals that are unseen, you know, from land. But once you get in the water, everything becomes very apparent. And I really think that's the key. So that guest who had mentioned, you know, get young people involved early is absolutely correct. And I've seen that in just a little bit of time that I've had to watch people, you know, react to my story and to the other stories around it.
And our world has changed so dramatically from the curse and the blessing of the computer and of our iPhones. And, you know, in our family, we call them gizmos and being attached to those. And it's really robbed a lot of kids from experiencing nature. I mean, you have the inner city kid that experience hasn't changed much, whether they have a phone or not. But for a lot of other kids who used to go play outside, and now, oh, well, that's not safe. I mean, I just ran crazy wild. From the time I was born, there were no boundaries. My mother had this bell that was from a ship, and she'd ring the bell, and we could hear it for a really, really, you know, long distance, and she'd ring the bell, and we knew it was time to go home. So for our listeners, it's like press pause and set a day every month at least to go on a picnic, feel grass, look at trees. I mean, there are free and accessible opportunities to come in with nature, commune with nature, and it's so important, I think, now more than ever.
Yeah, absolutely.
And look what happened. Our disconnection with nature, I think, has led to a lot of the problems. Nobody's watching all of the things and the devastation of the forests and all those things because we will want to protect them. So let's talk a little bit about whales. Or do you want to go to weird? Because whales.
Let's go to whales. This is very weird. This sort of fits both of those.
Okay, good. Weird and whales. Let's do it.
So, sperm whales have, I mean, where do I really start here? Sperm whales have a brain that is 6 times the size of ours. It is in many ways more evolved than ours. They've had these brains for 50 million years longer than we've had ours. Humans have had our current size brain about 250,000 years. In the scope of brain evolution, that is nothing. Whales have had their current size brain around 50 million years. They have spindle cells. These are the very long and evolved cells that humans associate with very evolved trains of thought, conscious thinking, future thought, all those things that separate us from other animals. Sperm whales have those in a far larger profusion than we have them. So if any animal is talking in a very sophisticated way, it's likely going to be sperm whales. So that is why this group of freelance researchers is so interested in discovering what these animals are saying, how they're saying it, and how they might be trying to communicate with us. I know that sounds completely insane. So there's your weird part of that.
But it doesn't. It's fascinating to me. I just want to learn more. And the thought that flashed on my mind was like, and people hunt them and kill them. So let's not go there. Let's keep talking on the up note. It's like, how could you kill a whale? Okay. They're so smart.
Yeah, they are so smart. And something amazing, really amazing, happens when you free dive with these animals. So I think I mentioned this before. These things are, you know, the size of a school bus. They have huge mouths with these huge teeth. They usually eat 60-foot-long squid. And yet, when you dive with them, they approach you in complete peace. And the way that they see you, whales don't really use their eyes too much, but they see through echolocation, which is a kind of sonar. They send out a click. It sounds like a big snap, and they wait for the echo of that click to come back. And they use that information to see, they can see a human in the water from a mile away. They can be a mile beneath you and see you perfectly clear. So those snaps, those clicks they use are so loud that they will shake your body, and your body feels like it starts to heat up after you're around whales for too long. But what's really interesting, if I could just prattle on a little longer here,
I love it.
Not only do they use these clicks for echolocation, they also use them for communication. So once you're around the whales and once they click you to discover what you are, that you have lungs, you have a large brain, because these clicks are like x-rays. They can literally see what's on the outside of your body and what's on the inside. This is all scientifically proven. This isn't, some theory. So once they see that we're unlike anything else in the ocean, they start sending communication clicks because they figure, hey, you've got a large brain, you've got lungs just like us. Maybe we can have a little conversation.
Maybe we
here.
Can click back.
Maybe we can click. And that is, in a nutshell, that's what these guys are trying to do. They're trying to click back because they've had so many experiences with these whales saying the equivalent of, hello, you know, are you there? Hey, we're over here. And we haven't been able, if we're so smart, why can't we figure out how to click back? And hopefully we'll be clicking back soon. I don't know when exactly, but we're moving forward, and hopefully we'll make some progress there.
And hopefully you'll let Mrs. Green's World know so that we can be the first interview. Late breaking news.
Absolutely.
Of a
just send you a couple
nature.
Clicks.
Yes,
yeah,
send me a couple of clicks, and I'll pick it up.
You'll know it's good. Yeah, exactly.
But it is such a highly sophisticated form of communicating without using words. I mean, it's fascinating to me what lies beneath, and it makes me even more passionate about why it's so imperative that we not just preserve, but really get on cleaning up the oceans. And it makes me understand why people are interested. I mean, we could so learn from the whales. I'm sure we could learn a lot.
I'm sure we could. And, you know, their communication, everyone says, is thinking like it's filled with vowels and consonants and sentences. This mode of communication is likely so much more sophisticated than anything we use to communicate. And if anyone out there saw the movie Arrival, a big popular movie last year about aliens communicating, that was all based on cetacean communication. The spectrogram readouts they had were of cetacean communication. That was a little nudge, nudge, wink, wink to everyone who was doing cetacean. The aliens in that movie, bared a very striking resemblance to underwater animals, specifically whales. So that whole movie is based on, at least the way I saw it, and picking up on the little cued references in there, that is based on making contact with underwater animals, specifically whales.
I wrote it down in big letters and circled it because that's the fun stuff that I get to do after I interview a guest like you is find decent things to watch on Netflix. I'm sure I can get it. I mean, that's
amazing
fascinating. And
movie.
I look at it through different eyes.
Yeah, it's an alien movie without lasers or without wars. It's all based on interspecies communication, specifically about cetacean communication. So highly recommended.
I mean, I absolutely love it. So talk about, on the scale, what about sharks? I mean, I have a friend, and I've mentioned him many times on the show. He has gone diving, scuba diving, in places that, like, it scares me just to even think that he's there, but he's not afraid of anything. And he talks about, he has gone swimming with every kind of shark you can think of, and I'm barely kidding, and he has videos of them, which makes me even more terrified. What did you learn about sharks? And were you in the water? Were you scared? What? Tell us about the applications for humans and scientists, what they're learning about sharks.
Well, as a swimmer and a surfer, you know, from Southern California and a surfer up here in Northern California, I've learned, like, I am shark bait. I'm swimming on the surface of the water. I look exactly like a seal in my wetsuit. I've got a board on. So sharks, you know, I totally respect them, understand that they're an important part of the, underwater ecosystem, but I would prefer to avoid them.
I am laughing hard because my husband, when he sees these videos, he says, "I don't care. Sharks see us as shark bait." He has used those words. He said, he doesn't even want to snorkel anywhere where there are sharks in the immediate vicinity. So that just gave me quite a chuckle. You are shark bait.
Well, they do. You are shark bait, and you are viewed as bait if you look like their bait, which is on the surface, flopping around in the water, you know, with your limbs out. But something amazing happens, just as I'm sure your scuba diver friend would say the same thing. When you go beneath the surface and you look at this animal in the eyes and you hang out with it, there is a huge paradigm shift that occurs. Their prey doesn't go down to their eye level and look them in the eyes, okay? Their prey is looking the other way, swimming as fast as it can to get away from them. So they immediately recognize you are not their prey. You are hanging out with them. You are interacting with them. And oftentimes, those interactions become extremely friendly, and they start frolicking around. They completely get it, that there is something else going on here. Now, having said that, sharks still absolutely freak me out. I've gone freediving with them a few times. I've looked them in the eyes. I've had that connection with them. But you're talking about an animal that, you know, for the past 150 million years, it hasn't evolved at all because it hasn't needed to. This is the most efficient killing machine on the planet. But I know freedivers who die.
Just to hear that, yes.
But what's interesting is, you know, and there's different species of sharks. Bull sharks are very nasty, and I try to stay away from them. But cow sharks and great whites are actually pretty docile. And what's interesting, though, is to go down there and free dive with them or scuba dive with them, you understand what a truly sophisticated, majestic animal this is. And what I learned later after I went free diving with them is they have the most incredible sense of direction. Absolutely blew me away that these animals every year can swim around 1,000 feet down where it's pitch black all the time. Doesn't matter if it's day or night or whatever. They can swim in a straight line for thousands of miles, reach the exact beach they were at the year before, and then turn around and swim back in a straight line and find the beach they just came from. Now, how is that possible?
How is that possible? Compass. You have any clue?
They can't look at the sun. They can't take celestial navigation through the stars. There's tides. It's pitch black all the time. And what they discovered about 2 decades ago is that these animals have something called magnetoreception, which is essentially a compass in their head that homes in on the Earth's magnetic field. And they can use that to precise as modern GPS to go from one point on the planet to the other. And where this gets really fascinating is not only do sharks have that, but guess what? Birds have it, because how do they migrate from one tree 1,000 miles away and back again over and over and over? Butterflies have it, bees have it, ants have it, and of course humans have it as well. So in the book I tried to look at these, not just say, wow, sharks are these amazing animals, but how do they relate to us? How do we, you know, share similar reflexes and senses? And human magnetoreception is getting very popular right now. People are exploring it. And this enabled us to, sail across stormy seas for thousands of miles that allowed us to navigate through forests across the deserts. And we still have it to a certain extent. It's just our cell phones and GPS have sort of taken over some of that.
Yeah, but it's still just brings up the whole conversation about how much more there's still to learn. I mean, we have barely scratched the surface when I hear things that you talk about and that you've been involved in. It just reminds us that we just know a little thimbleful of what's going on. Let's go back a little bit. Do you want to comment on that before I move on?
I do, just very quickly, that it's interesting because science, 100 years ago, used to be the exploration of the unknown.
Right.
If it was unknown, it was worthy of scientific study. But what I've found is these people who are very interested in these, some might call it weird studies or human potential studies or interspecies connected studies, it is so hard for them to find funding to do anything. You know, if you have a new drug that has potential of, regrowing hair, you can get $1 billion at any time.
So but true. For discoveries, oh my God.
Discoveries that are truly going to shape and change our lives on these planets for the better, you can't get a penny to do this stuff. So the person that was doing magnetoreception, human magnetoreception studies, was ostracized from his university. He was called a fool. They said, go away. And he said, no, I have the data. It's all right here. Why don't you look? No one would look at it. 20 years later, of course, what did they discover? He was 100% right. So this keeps happening. And so I guess this, I have no real point here beyond mentioning this, but
it is a very, very important point. It is the quintessence of important points, something that could potentially benefit so many human beings. And I think about weird things like we have so many kids with autism. So you see where this whirling dervish brain goes, who knows what tools could be discovered that would help kids with autism, calm them down, communicate in different ways, learn how to click. Like, I'm barely kidding. So those things that are so important to the health of the planet, we give money to studies for Viagra and hair replacement. Thank you so much. I was watching TV a little bit last night because I just had to, go through the pain of seeing what CNN was doing. And there was a commercial for a drug. And I thought, I have no freaking clue what that drug is even for. And it was for children. And then it was, I'm not dumb. I don't have any idea what the drug was for. And then there was the 1 minute of rapidly smoking may result in, you know, diarrhea, cramps, neuritis, please. And if you go see your doctor. And I'm thinking, what is this? And when it comes to ocean exploration and even further, like now I'm on a tear, it's like even further, spending dollars to get kids to connect with nature so they have a more holistic and healthier outlook on preservation of the planet, quality of life, you name it. So yeah, you can go off on that tangent on Mrs. Green's World Show anytime you want. Where the heck is the money going and why are we wasting it on that? Spending billions of dollars for the next new pill. It's all about the money.
Yeah,
it's all about the money.
Is.
And I, of course, have no idea what my next question is because I have these occasional rants.
Mrs. Green's World's mission is to preserve the planet by creating a global community of people who care about the health of the Earth. We educate, inform, and inspire. Mrs. Green's World is an independent, non-political, agenda-free voice. Your generous gift enables all of us to explore the issues facing the health of the planet in a comprehensive way. As a Mrs. Green's World sustainer, you can assist us in offering trusted information, providing listeners with the tools to make their own conclusions and choose their own steps to create a healthier planet. Visit MrsGreensWorld.com and click on Become a Member today.
Let's talk about the connection to the ocean. You mentioned it a little bit, and I'm curious as to, you know, I thought about where really, you know, our first 9 months are spent in water, and then we come out. So there's a deep connection there to water. And what are some of the physiological changes? It's calming for people. It's so many things. What did you observe by spending so much time beneath the surface?
Mm-hmm. Well, you're right. We develop as fetuses in an amniotic fluid that is 99% similar to seawater.
Unreal.
Could this be a crazy coincidence? I don't think so.
I don't think so.
The blood that courses through our veins from the time that we're born all the way until the day we die is 98% similar to seawater. It has a similar chemical composition. We're just missing one molecule. So we really have the ocean within our veins. It's where we all came from. It's where everything, all life, all matter on the planet is eventually going to return to. So there is a very large arc right there. And, you know, the relationships and the interconnections between oceanic animals seem so distant now, but we all came from the same stuff. And we still share many of the same genes. And as I try to explore in the book, we also share many of the same senses as oceanic animals, from magnetoreception, which I talked about, to echolocation. We talked about how whales and dolphins echolocate through this sonar. It turns out that humans also know how to echolocate. And I found these blind activists in Los Angeles who have taught themselves whale echolocation and now live completely free lives. They travel alone. They go camping alone in the woods for weeks at a time. These guys ride mountain bikes through city streets.
And they're blind.
You know, on days that I would never even ride my bike, through. They're completely, not legally blind, 100% blind. And I just got a note from this guy yesterday, and we're going to reconnect in LA, because when I hung out with them, their plight and what they're doing really triggered something in me. They were told, one of the guys, Brian Bushway, amazing guy, completely lost his eyesight at the age of 14. And he was taught by the blind community. They said, here's your cane, here's your dog, here's the post office, here's a restaurant, have fun the rest of your life. Well, this guy was an athlete. He was an avid mountain biker, skateboarder, a musician. He said, I'm not going to do this. So he started working with another guy who had developed something called flash sonar, which is based on echolocation. And now they have created a foundation. It's called World Access for the Blind, one of the most amazing, inspiring foundations around there, where they go around the world and they teach kids how to echolocate so they can live independent lives.
You are kidding me.
I am not. And that's a guy I think you should get on your show.
I do, too.
He can speak much. So it's these kind of outliers, these people who have decided to do things on their own terms, who have sort of bucked the system to really affect positive change directly in a real way that I'm really attracted to. I don't know why. I just see them having a real impact on the planet that is tangible and that is happening now. Outside of institutions and organizations, these people can really connect with people in a real way. And that guy is just so amazing. So what we're going to do in the next year, I hope, I haven't broached this to him, so please don't tell him this if you talk to him yet. Maybe I'll talk to him about it.
I promise. It's the cone of silence.
I mentioned this to him a year ago, is since he is able to see the world through echoes, because he sends out a click and he waits for the echo of that click to come back and he views the world that way, we want to get him in the water with some sperm whales.
Oh, my gosh.
Because we're thinking that possibly he would be able to crack into what they are seeing around their environment as well. And he is adventurous enough to want to do it. And that could be a bridge to something. And I know a lot of people are saying, this is insane, what a stupid idea, but hey, no one else has done it. You don't know until you try.
It's an awesome idea. It's an awesome, excellent idea. You've got to be kidding me. Who better to connect with the whales than someone that's already clicking? I mean, seriously, I cannot even believe that you're sharing this with me. It's like super, super incredibly exciting and thrilling. And talk about applying what was learned to blind people and their quality of life. And, you know, my mother went blind towards the end of her life. She had macular degeneration, which is not the same. I understand that. But it is, to be blind in this world is way worse than being deaf and a lot of other handicaps. People are not kind sometimes to blind people. It's amazing to me. I'm recovering from this. Like, this is unreal. And if you will, I'll ask Kelly to be in touch with you so we can get his contact information. What an amazing show that would be. Oh, my gosh.
Sure.
I think that would be wonderful. Let's talk for a little bit, and we are not going to have a break. I don't want a break, so I just signaled our soundboard operator, no breaks. We have to keep going with the flow, and that's what the joy of having your own network brings to my life. But what about, you know, you started with free diving, and I'd like you to talk a little bit about what shape our oceans are in. What are some of your concerns? I don't like to use the word fear. I don't want to be fear-based, but what are some of your concerns and things that you'd like to share with our audience around the world about our oceans? What are the concerns and why it's so vitally important that we pay attention? I mean, they give us oxygen. We need them to breathe. So that's a good reason. But what are you finding in terms of plastics and, you know, extinction and kill rates and all of that stuff?
Yeah, well, it's not good. I'll just put it that way. We do need the ocean to breathe. That's where the vast majority of oxygen comes, not from trees, but from the ocean.
Right.
Plankton is dying off. 70% of the coral is dead. Sharks continue to be hunted for soup. I could go on and on. I had a big realization when I was traveling around. You know, every 2 weeks I go to a different ocean in a different country to hang out with different people. And what I was seeing, unless you get far off the coast, is complete devastation. And, you know, as far as, you know, what to do, I think people are now conscious that the oceans are in trouble. But because we can't see it, people have a problem really identifying with it. And that was sort of the purpose of the book, to take people from the surface of the ocean down to the deepest, the absolute deepest point on the planet, and to show people all the different wonders of that underwater world, to get them to want to preserve it. But I really have no, you know, question or no statement about that beyond the fact that we're in very, very, very deep trouble right now. And the saddest thing to me is that you know, okay, so humans have dug, we've dug our own hole here, and we've really messed up the environment for ourselves. But what breaks my heart is that our naivete and our inconsideration of other animals who have lived on this planet as wonderful stewards of this earth, dolphins, whales, sharks, they've been perfect. Their system works beautifully. And they have been perfect stewards of this earth for millions of years. We come around and destroy their environment. And that's what's so sad to me. And to see that human pollution, sound pollution for whales, we're sending these sonar blasts to try to find oil in deep waters. And it's deafening whales. A deaf whale is a dead whale. You know, I could go on and on. But it's bad. I think that in order to affect real change, we're going to have to get governments involved on a global scale. And right now seems like a pretty dark time for that. But hopefully,
say, yeah,
in the next couple of years, you know, this will be a wake-up call for everyone. And that's what I'm hoping this is.
Me too. I'm hoping that things are so outrageous and so egregious that people who have been asleep for most of their entire life, and I'm not saying that in any, you know, condescending way, especially Americans. And, you know, when you talk about all of these things, people ask me a lot when I do public speaking, what is the solution to climate change? How can we even make a difference? And I say the answer, it's one answer. What our problem is overpopulation and overconsumption. And you might not be able to do anything about overpopulation if you're not having kids anymore, or if you're going to, you know, have one or two. But overconsumption is the root of all evil. And someone in Tucson, Arizona, or Podunk, Idaho, or wherever can have an impact on the oceans by reducing their consumption of plastics. It's there is a trail that you can connect to the oceans and the health of the whales and all of that. And I say to people, you know, what's happening on Midway Island with what Chris Jordan documents, nobody lives there. It's hundreds of miles away from any inhabitants, and those albatross are dying in record numbers because of someone's little toothpaste canister getting thrown in the ocean, or a plastic container. So to me, that's always the call to action: consume less. And if hundreds of thousands of us stop doing it, it will help.
You're absolutely right. That is the key, is just consume less, you know, reuse stuff. Single-use plastics, I think, are probably the number one problem in the oceans right now. Single-use plastics.
I agree. Like straws.
Start with that.
500 million straws a day. 500 million straws a day.
Plastic bags.
Plastic bags.
Plastic water bottles. So you know, that's definitely the way to start.
And it's, as you said, a very recent phenomenon it's all balled up in the disconnection between humans and nature and overconsumption and the craziness around that. And we need to like put the brakes on all of it and teach our kids, because it's killing fish. And I always say on shows like this, nobody really wants to kill a bird. Nobody says, oh, I'm just going to throw that in the garbage. I don't care if it kills a bird. Nobody wants to hurt birds. Well, most decent people, but it's that consciousness about that. So I want to ask two more questions, because the time will rapidly disappear.
Yep.
What about when you wrote the book? I mean, it really has been a phenomenal success, and I don't say that lightly. Phenomenal success. When you were writing it, did you have any idea it was going to take off like it did?
I didn't. When you're so enveloped in writing, the only thing you want to do and you teach yourself how to do is just to keep writing and to get it done. I had a really aggressive deadline on this book, so I was living, breathing this stuff for around 18 months, night and day, and I loved it. You know, there wasn't one moment where I was like, oh, what am I doing? This is stupid. You know, I'd be in airports on layovers for 10 hours in a row, you know, trying to get to Mozambique and Reunion Island takes a long time. And I was just constantly consumed by it. And I still am. And that's the real neat thing, is after the book came out, a lot of people move on to their next project and, you know, begin new work on a different subject. But I'm so, excuse the pun, but deep within this world now, and
no,
I see the progress happening with whale communication, and it just excites me more than it ever has. I'm free diving more now than I ever have, and I feel that connection with the ocean, and I really am inspired when it inspires other people to connect in the same way that I have. That to me is really the greatest compliment.
It's just, I mean, it is one of the most interesting journeys that I have gotten to hear about in 10 years. And I don't say that lightly. It's like, wow, there's so much here. And as I said, I'm a Jersey girl, grew up in the oceans. I mean, swam all summer, every day, all day. And you don't ever forget that. It matters. And I, you know, we didn't say anything about when I got stung by jellyfish, because that stays with you forever, too. It's like, man, that was one of the most, most traumatic experiences of my life. And when did the book, you know, not just was it a commercial success, which it is, and a literary success and a phenomenon that many people are interested in. How do you... Like, I'm so proud of you, because I made a joke when we were talking off air that you're not a social media guru. It's like, to say the least. Do you think that helps with you and the strength of your message? And I hope I can ask this question right. To me, social media is such a diversion. And a perfect example is, like, when I go to Bioneers, I'm there as press, and I don't do any press while I'm there. Like, none. Because I want to be fully present. If you're tweeting, you're not present. If you're putting stuff on Facebook, you're not present. So I go and I receive. I listen to guests. I make notes about that. I learn and I grow. Do you have any comments on social media as a distraction for the... You're doing some deep work, and that's not a pun either. I mean, you really are. It matters to our civilization, the work that you're doing and the people you're connecting and putting the spotlight on. What's your...
Oh, well, thank...
I really believe that.
Thank you for that. I really, really appreciate that. That's very, very kind. I mean, as far as social media is concerned, I understand the importance of it. I understand that it's a great tool for getting out messages. However, I've also found that you can spend all day on your computer replying to emails and not get anything at all done, and all day on Facebook, checking Facebook and not getting anything done. So I've instituted a pretty hard policy. I check email twice a day. And if someone wants to contact me, they can contact me anytime on my phone. And what I've found by doing that is all the problems that arrive, I'd say 90% of the questions, hey, do you know where this is? Hey, you know, can you send me that right away? All of those are answered by the time I get on email. Because now people are so trigger happy with email that they ask for everything all the time, even though what they're looking for is usually right directly in front of them. Facebook and Twitter, I understand the importance. Some people are very good at it. I'm awful at it. I kind of stay off it most of the time because I don't want to be consumed in a virtual world. I want to be consumed in the real world and try to be more productive in every day, to be less busy, like with just busy tasks, and more productive. And by being more productive, I think I can contribute more. So
that is a great message, though. It's not good. It's not healthy. I mean, when you see what has happened to our society, just with cell phones at dinners, and when I go to restaurants and, you know, I see these families come in and they literally park their kids, and their kids have something, a gizmo, and it's not in our family. We park our phones. They're not allowed. And, you know, my grandkids are good about it and my kids are good about it. It's just an unhealthy connection. And what I think is awesome about your story is look at the success you've enjoyed. And I mean success by getting your message spread. That's how I'm defining success. Mm. That you have your message being spread without having to do that. I mean, and I can't help myself. I have to say, so now we have a president that tweets. Like, really? How's that working for you, Don? Oh my gosh, I can't help it. I try to keep this show apolitical. It's getting harder and harder. You know, I have to stand in my truth too, but I mean, I do not think that the best and highest use of my president's time is on Twitter. It's disgusting. It's like,
I agree with you, but here's the great thing about it is not being on Twitter, I don't have to see what the guy is saying at all.
So, it's really,
maybe ignorance is bliss in that regard.
Stay
just in that one area.
Yes,
so.
Stay in that shell and let other people take your message out for you. I think that's one of the most beautiful parts of it. And of course, I want to say to my listeners, you can find out about James Nestors by just doing one simple thing. And it is the wonder of the internet and all that's good about the advances we've made. But just put him in Google and there will be lots of little links that light up. And I would not recommend you follow him on Facebook because it's his personal page. Don't do that. But learn about James Nestor and his message and buy the book on Amazon or in your local bookstore. That would be more important to me. We still have local bookstores in our town, and people remind me, don't order it on Amazon. Go to the local bookstore, and they will order almost anything you want. So this has been delightful, James Nestor. Thank you for showing up in Mrs. Green's world. We have some great shows next week from TMC, a physiologist about heart health, and Mayor Jim Brainerd, all aboard the goal of Mayor Jim Brainerd, who was in the administration supporting climate change as a Republican. James, thank you.
Thank you so much. That was so much fun. I really appreciate your time.
It was fun.